Welcome back to the Pathfinder 101 podcast.
Today's guest for this podcast will be Mr. John Gross, a geophysicist who currently works as a director at Tellurium. Welcome, Mr. Gross, and let's jump right into the questions.
Good morning.
Could you briefly describe the role of a geophysicist?
Okay, well, there are different types of geophysicists. Some are working in the academic arena, like earthquake seismology, that kind of things. And there are government jobs, like for the USGS, volcanology, all sorts of disciplines that involve geophysics. The kind of geophysics that I was attracted to had to do with the petroleum industry. And when I started back in 1981, there was a pretty strong demand for petroleum geophysicists. And geophysicists, or they could be also called explorationists. Okay, so we're looking at the subsurface for potential drilling targets, working side by side with geologists to essentially predict what's underneath the ground. I mean, we're talking about anywhere between 5,000 feet down to 20,000 feet. So when you're trying to predict what you're going to find, it's something that needs to be done because the cost of drilling a well is so high that you need to lower the risk of failure. That's the whole idea. And so the science that goes into it, there's a lot of geology, a little bit of math that's required. Well, I could go on into more detail about a little bit of what we're doing. Is that
will come up a little later in the interview.
All right, that's fine.
So you mentioned geology. What are the similarities and differences between geologists and geophysicists?
Okay, good question. So one way of looking at it is that both disciplines need geologic background. So in other words, if you're thinking about going into the profession, then you would be majoring in some kind of earth science. And so you will take courses in sedimentology and to understand the geologic processes that might create subsurface reservoirs for oil and gas. Okay. And these days, by the way, the same reservoirs that might contain oil and gas might also, once they're depleted, they might also be candidates for carbon capture and sequestration, pump the carbon down into the same reservoir. So the geologists and the geophysicists need to work together to find that reservoir. So the geologist will study the nearby well control. So wells that have previously been drilled, they have been tested with well logs. And a well log is a tool that's lowered down the wellbore to directly measure the rocks. Different types of logs tell us different kinds of rock properties. Is it a sand or is it a shale? Does it have water in the pore space or does it contain hydrocarbon? Okay, so that's a direct measurement. But generally the wells are few and far between because like I said, they're expensive to drill. But the geologist will look at those wells and picture a map, if you will, with dots on it. And each dot might be the location of a well. Well, subsurface going down, let's say 10 to 12,000 feet, the geologist can understand which layers are where, and then geologists can make a map of that to predict where a suitable structure might be. Now, the geophysicist, though, comes at it from a different technology. And we use reflection seismology to essentially put sound waves down into the earth in that area, and the reflections off of the layers come back, and we can process that data on supercomputers and make an image of those reflections. Now, the seismic data does not tell you what the rock is, but it tells you where the reflections are. And the reflections are in time because you're measuring the time that it takes for the sound wave to go down, bounce off that layer and come back. Now, but the geophysicists also then will be interested in the velocity of that creates that travel time. And if you understand, and if you know time and you know the velocity, then you can predict the depth. Or if you know the time and the depth, then you can predict the velocity. So it's the combination of the well control, which tells you what the rocks actually are and at what depth, and then the seismic, which is recorded in time, where you see a very detailed picture of the layers. So you're actually seeing a picture, imagine a cross-section that is telling you the structure, sort of like a topographic map, and you're seeing the structure that's in between the wells. Because there may be several wells drilled in the area, they might all be dry holes, but the actual hydrocarbon accumulation might be in between where those wells are drilled. And that's what the seismic could tell you.
Sounds very fascinating and complicated.
It is, but that's okay. There's no limit to what you can learn in the profession.
What were some of the stepping stones, such as like in terms of education or your entry role or certain experiences to where you are today?
Well, where I am today is very different from where I started. Today, I am semi-retired. I am a director at a public company. So I'm on the board. I'm not actually an employee of the company. And the company is, it's called Tellurian Incorporated. It's a company that is involved in LNG, liquefied natural gas. So we are building a liquefied natural gas export facility. And we also have an upstream department in the company that is drilling wells looking for gas. So if we have the gas and then we build a pipeline to take the gas to the export facility, then we would liquefy the gas, put it on ships, and send it to Europe. And there's all sorts of economic reasons why that's a good idea. Europe depends on natural gas. And as we all know, Russia has cut off the gas to Europe, and Europe is looking to the United States for help. It's a long-term proposition. These things take years to build. So there's no quick fix, but we are working on it. Now, what does LNG have to do with where I started in geophysics? So I did start as a geophysicist for a major oil company, Amoco Production Company, back in the early 80s. And that was after receiving a degree in geophysical science during college. But I was really attracted to the idea of exploring for oil and gas. And so I just jumped right in. The industry went through many ups and downs along the way, but I stayed with the company. Fortunately, they did not lay me off. I was there for 17 years. Now, I left the company for, let's say, better or let's say more challenging opportunities, and went instead of going to another large company, I went to a small company where I could wear more hats. When you're in a small company, you've got to, you know, depending on the reason why they're hiring you, you have your main profession, but you may also be required to do other types of work. As it turned out, about a year later, I ended up at a small startup called Cheniere Energy. Now, Cheniere Energy had a project with seismic data, again, my trade, and we were looking for gas, no LNG at the time, but just looking for gas that if you drill the wells, then you sell the gas and that's how you make your money. The company was so small that we needed somebody to handle the IT part of the company, all the computers, the computer network and data and storage and all of those things. And I wasn't a direct fit for that, but I was the best fit amongst the people that were there. And there were only a handful of us. And I had picked up a fair amount of IT background doing the exploration work because the discipline, the geophysics, That requires a lot of data. So you've got a lot of heavy duty data storage requirements, and you need more powerful networks, and things have to run at a high speed. You need to make sure your data is backed up. All you have to worry about security. I mean, the cybersecurity threats that we have today have existed, you know, ever since we've had computer networks. That experience for me was, you could call it, on the job training. And I had to teach myself the IT discipline and also function as a geophysicist. As we grew, I became the exploration manager. So I became a vice president within the company and was responsible for the exploration effort. And I had a small staff working for me, and we had our corporate computer network plus the exploration network. So that continued to grow, and the company then pivoted into LNG. And as we did that, the company went from about 25 people up to about 100 people in a hurry. So the company did an LNG project, which was sold to another party, but then we immediately launched another LNG project. The company grew to about 400 people. So now this is getting really big. And my boss, the CEO, agreed that it was too big for me to wear two hats. And so we hired a full-time CIO, Chief Information Officer. There was about a year-long transition process there. Ever since then, I've always had an interest in the IT part of the oil and gas industry runs on IT. There's no question about it. So what happened to our company, though, is that the exploration part of it stayed at the same size. The LNG part of the company grew to be a pretty big company. And a short time later, my team and I, we left the company and went to work for a different company. So along the way, though, I'm picking up skills that really have to do with running a public company. And in a public company, you've got to deal with accounting, disclosures. You know, every public company has to put out a 10K every year and three 10Qs, you know, on a quarterly basis. And every part of the company is responsible for properly disclosing to the public, to investors, the actual current, you know, status of the company and the whole, let's say that I got a lot of experience working with other executives, attorneys, chief financial officer, et cetera, on how these types of disclosures should be done. And also, I got a lot of exposure to how board of directors functions. And this is all in addition to the normal day-to-day and preparing budgets and reporting to the CEO what's going on and being ready and essentially progressing the program and finding oil and gas, which is what we did. Now, I said when we left the company, that was in 2008, and went to work for another company, that's because there was a whole industry-wide downturn. It took a few years for Cheniere to recover from that economic catastrophe and become an export company. That was driven by the massive supply of shale gas that we have in the United States. That technology did not exist, you know, 20 years before. It really came into, really hit its stride around 2007, 2008. And ever since then, the country has honestly more gas than we know what to do with. And there's been a whole, you know, LNG export industry that has grown up around that. But Cheniere was the first. Now, I came back to Cheniere as a director, and this was in 2013, and Cheniere had a complicated corporate structure with three public entities, and I was asked to be a director of one of them. So now I got experience actually being a director, and the role of a director in a public company is to oversee management. Now, management runs the company. Management is responsible for doing the accounting and creating the disclosures, but the board approves the disclosures. And so the skill set that you need to do that really has to do with experience in financial oversight, a little bit of accounting, and let's say strategic planning. Again, at the very high level, the management is creating that plan, but it's under the oversight of the board. Now, the reason for that is that independent directors that are not on the management team represent the stockholders. That is the reason to have a board of directors. Now, it's also, by the way, it's a requirement under stock exchange rules that each of those entities has its own rules, but there's quite a bit of overlap, but you must comply with those rules. So we're making sure, we're watching management because we're representing the stockholders. Management, they have other interests because their compensation depends on the performance of the company, but it is the board that creates those goals and metrics that the management must hit in order to achieve their compensation. Somebody has to be looking out for the stockholders. So what I've really described here is that takes us up to 2018. Subsequent to that, now I'm a director at Tellurian. But throughout that time, I was still a practicing geophysicist, but you could say I wasn't the guy in front of a workstation making the maps. I was, let's say, leading other guys that are doing the exploration and keeping the program moving forward. So in other words, if you are a geophysicist and you want to stay within that discipline strictly, there's a career path. You can become a manager, managing guys that are actually doing the actual work, but you're not going to become a very good manager if you can't do the work yourself. Well, about 2009, I actually became a consultant, and I had enough knowledge and background that I could jump into just about any situation and help turn around their program or assist them in the interpretation of the data or help get their data organized, whatever it may be. Because remember, I had the IT skill set plus the explorationist skill set. And I did consulting work for about 10 years. That was very rewarding. And you can choose who you want to work with. Of course, you've got to make a deal in order to get paid as an independent consultant. You have to have credibility, a background. And that really comes from being in the industry for 30 or 40 years, and you know people that you knew earlier in your career, you may cross paths with later in your career, and some of them may want to hire you. I know a lot of people in the industry, and of course, I'm at the age now where people are retiring, but it's been highly rewarding. I mean, everywhere I go, if it's to a convention or whatever, I always run into people that, you know, maybe I haven't seen in 20 years. But those networking opportunities, that's really how you build up your network so that people know who you are, you're on their radar. You know, you may run into somebody that is working on a deal and it looks attractive, and maybe there's a way to partner in some way, whatever that is. It may take a year to bring that deal to fruition. I was a consultant for a company for 8 years, eight straight years. It's very rare on a consultant basis. I mean, usually these are short-term type of jobs, but this was an eight-year relationship, but it took a whole year of discussions to actually do it. So you got to be patient. We started with geophysics, but then it became management, and then it became exposure to IT, and then exposure to contracts, budgets, accounting, legal, corporate disclosures. I mean, it's just on and on. It just sort of proliferated into all of these different disciplines. And for me, I found all of them interesting. There wasn't anything that I did not like along the way. Now, these days, being a director at a company, that suits me just fine. It's part-time. but I get to work with some of the smartest people I've ever met. Bottom line is, for me, I've had a wide variety of different things to do in my career, and I've enjoyed every minute of it.
When you were in high school, did you know that this was the career you wanted to pursue, like a geophysicist? Or if not, what were some of the things that you did in college to determine whether this was the right thing for you?
Yeah, good question. In high school, no, I did not know what I wanted to do. My father was a doctor in Dallas, and I, you know, he didn't pressure me or anything, but I knew he wanted me to become a doctor. In high school, I did not know what I wanted to do, but I was pretty sure that I, because that's a huge commitment. Now, I made a huge commitment on, you know, my career path. I mean, I was all in, but I did not know what I wanted to do in high school. But having said that, we all took freshman earth science. And back in the 70s, our earth science teacher was Mr. Dexter. He was one of the best, most dynamic teachers that I've ever had, and also one of the hardest. So imagine this, I took freshman earth science and I was blown away. I was amazed. And we did, you know, all types of earth science, because it was, you know, a year-long course studying all types of earth science, a little bit of meteorology, astronomy as well. And I was just blown away, but I made C's in it. I could not get A's on those tests. I mean, I thought, oh my God, this is the hardest subject. And yet I'm attracted to it. So much that I said, when I'm a senior, I want to take Mr. Dexter's courses, sedimentology. I think there was some paleontology and some meteorology. And the only way to cram that in was to take chemistry during the summer. And that, you know, that just blew my summer. But I did it because I really wanted to take Mr. Dexter's classes. So I got in there and I took the classes, loved every minute of it, and got blown away on the test. Okay. So when I went off to college, I still didn't know what I wanted to do. And it really wasn't until really at the end of my first year when I was required to declare a major. I said, well, okay, I'm just going to put it out there and see what happens. And I signed up for geophysical science. And so that's how I got into it. Now, the course requirements at the time, this was University of Chicago back in the 70s, on the quarter system, I only had to take 9 courses to get the degree, nine courses in the department. That means I had like the ability to take 30 other courses over the 4 years in anything I wanted. I mean, I had to satisfy the Common Core classes, social studies, humanities. You have to have some math, history, and art history, and all kinds of other courses. So I got a degree, essentially it was in liberal arts, but I took 9 geophysical science courses, and that's my degree. And that was enough to get me in the door, you know, fill out an application to go to work for Amoco Production Company. And I had to go through the interview process, but they hired me, and the rest just happened from there.
Are there any types of master's degree that someone can pursue to specialize in a certain area? Or are there any sorts of like licenses or continuing education?
Yeah. So these days, at least in the majors, I don't think you could get a job without a master's degree. Things have just changed. But one thing that's different now is the degree that you might get and then the master's degree following that would be far more applied than what I went through. What I went through is more of the general theoretical background. For example, I took a course in earthquake seismology. If you know you're going into the oil and gas area, that may or may not be required depending on where you go to school. But what you will get exposure to is that we didn't, is you will get exposure to the actual data and the software so that when you come out, you will already know how to actually sit down in front of the workstation and do the work. Compared to what I did, it is not a waste of time under the new way of, you know, that companies do recruiting. Because when you're still in school, even studying for your master's, you may actually have access to software and a real data set, and you may be doing some very specialized work that might be worthy of writing a peer-reviewed paper. And that's a good experience. But when you graduate, you will already be somewhat familiar with the software. That software didn't exist when I came out. We all had to learn it on the job. Now, as far as licensing, in the oil and gas, at least I can't speak for every state, but in Texas, if you're practicing geophysics in the oil and gas sector, there's no license requirement. There is a license requirement for geologists and geophysicists if you are doing work in the public domain. For example, if you are doing geotechnical work that might be in conjunction with engineers, like if you're building a structure and geotechnical work is involved before they can design the building or the dam or whatever it may be, that does require a license.
You briefly talk about some of your daily responsibilities, like how a typical day or week looks like for you.
As far as the typical day is concerned, it's an office job. You work whatever hours are required. These jobs are considered professional. They are exempt in terms of compensation. So that means you're making a salary as opposed to an hourly wage, and you'll be paid a certain amount, you know, per year, whatever. I look at it as a typical desk job, an office job. But I would say that depending on what your career goals are, you may put in the minimum required, or you may put in a lot more than that, depending on what you want to do. I worked fairly long hours because I wanted to, but I believe that it certainly helped me along the way.
What do you like most about your job, and what do you like the least? Like, what are some of the challenges in this profession?
Well, I'll go back to the days when I worked at a major oil company. Now, I want to say that working for the major provided the best training that you could get. In a small company, they expect that you already have 20 years of experience and that you don't need any training, right? But at a major, they're hiring young people all the time, maybe not as many these days as years and years ago. However, if a young, let's say somebody that's interested in the profession, you're going to want to go to the right school. And if you go to the right school, then you'll have access to the recruiters who want to recruit at that school. For example, Colorado School of Mines, you know, that kind of path. And when you get into the company, then you'll be able to take advantage of the training and start building your network and learn how to do the job and hopefully become very, very good at what you do. And that's incredibly rewarding. On the flip side, that you're working for a big company and there's all kinds of large company initiatives and rules and meetings. And meetings are the worst part of it. I don't know if that's changed at all in the last 20 years, but I just remember, these meetings are required. You might have to sit through an hour and a half slide presentation that's done by the HR department. Why? Because it's required. And there's all sorts of gimmicky initiatives that companies do. Companies are always trying to improve their performance, but these are large companies that are so big and so far flung in locations and cities all over the world, you know, whether it's BP or Exxon or whoever, that the top management doesn't really run the day-to-day at these companies. And so they don't know what to do. So they hire outside consulting firms that tell them what to do. This is how you should compensate your employees. This is how you should incentivize them. This is how you should grade them for, you know, annual ranking, that kind of thing. And some of that stuff can be a little ugly, but you just have to deal with it in order to progress your career. And for me, I just tried to put my head down and power through it, because I thought that if I produced solid results that got noticed, that managers got to see it and my peers got to see it, that I would come out okay. All right. And the other thing about your peers is you want to involve your peers in your work. For example, in your department, there are going to be people that are really good at various questions that come up, geological questions, geophysical questions, and nobody knows everything. And you're going to want to go down the hall and ask a question to somebody who you trust and who you think is better at it than you are. And I always brought that, let's say, collective expertise into my projects. So everybody had a little hand in it, you know, and they got a little credit at the bottom, right? Special acknowledgement goes to, you know, so-and-so. And you'll be surprised how, you know, that can go a long way. And you're gonna learn from your peers, but then when the company is cutting back, your peers aren't gonna stab you in the back because they like you. So I think that it is inevitable that the oil and gas business will be cyclical. It's not going away, but it will be cyclical, and you need to ride out the bad times and enjoy the good times, ride out the bad times, always be a good friend to your peers and learn from them. So you can turn some of the ugliness into an asset, but in a big company, you can't get rid of all of the bad things. You are going to be hauled in once a year for a performance appraisal. And that's just the way it is. So my advice there is, if you can get high enough up in any company, it's always better to be giving the appraisal than to be getting the appraisal.
That's a good You've been talking a little bit about your curiosity, whichever department you go to, you're always like eager to learn more. And you've talked about networking and giving credit where it's due. What are some other skills or mindsets that have proved useful in your career?
Well, I would say certainly the soft skills, listening, and like I said, involving other people. Don't try to be a solo performer. A solo performer is just not going to get very far. And as my career went on, I would say that certainly the soft skills became more and more important. When I became a manager, I had seen good managers early in my career, and I had seen bad. I tried to keep tabs of what to do and what not to do, you know, when my time came. Always tell the truth, no matter what. Be straight with people. Everybody's got their own style, but I can tell you this, that whole idea of performance appraisals that we talked about. When I hired my team at Chenier, I told them on the way in, as I hired them, you're going to have to work really hard, but you're all going to make the same salary. I'm telling you that right up front. We're not playing any games with who's better than who. You're all going to be here because you've proven yourselves, and you better keep proving yourselves. You're not going to get an incremental raise because you're better than the other guy. You're either going to continue to be here or you're not. It's that simple. So just total, complete honesty. And of course, they all performed. So the skill or I don't know, luck, whatever you want to call it, of being able to identify these guys before they were in the door, that I knew they would succeed. And if they succeed, then I succeed. Then once they were in the door, all promises must be kept. The management, we promise these guys an override. That's a little piece of each well, that if they generated a prospect, and if we drilled the well, and if the well was a success, then they would get an ongoing piece of it that would survive even if they left the company. But they had to be here a certain period of time after production started in order to earn the override. But once they earn it, they keep it. Now, these are legal documents. They've got it. It's all got to get done. And I've seen companies where management made those promises and never followed through. And then the company failed. The wells kept producing, but the company failed, and those guys were out of luck, out of a job, and no override, even though it was promised. I'd seen that happen before. The industry can be cutthroat. I made the promise, and I made sure they got their overrides. To this day, my guys and I, we are all still friends. We're all the same age, but somebody's got to run the show. And they may not want to run the show. They may want to just do the work, but somebody's got to run the show. And I wanted to do it. And they knew that. And they wanted to do their job. So it all just worked. Okay. But these are skills that don't really have anything to do with the science. It's just, you know, interpersonal skills, recognizing some solid talent. None of them were superstars, but I'll tell you this, together, the results were really good. They were incentivized to collaborate, and that's how you get a better prospects. You don't want to be drilling dry holes. You want to drill producers, but you never know ahead of time. Again, no solo efforts. Everybody should be incentivized to collaborate. When I say soft skills, it's sort of what I'm talking about is the, let's say, the philosophy of, well, how do you set up a team? What's the best way to set up a team to get the business result that you're looking for? You need the technical background. No question about it. You have to know as much about what they do as they do themselves. But then you're layering on these other soft skills. And it can be, honestly, for me, it's been quite rewarding when you get the results.
Those are some great points to keep in mind. Thank you for those. In the U.S., it seems like there's sort of a push for more renewable energy over these other sources. How do you see that affecting the future for geophysicists and oil and gas?
Yeah, that's a real hot topic right now. So let me give a little perspective, because as a director of an LNG company, you might ask, well, why do we even need to be worrying about natural gas? And what does that mean if we're pushing toward renewables? What does that mean to the natural gas industry and LNG in particular? Well, and the answer is that, well, the whole developed world uses an incredible amount of energy. I mean, the economists can tell you how much energy we use and where it's used and what kinds of energy. Is it electricity? Is it natural gas, like for residential natural gas, or industrial use for natural gas, or petroleum itself? You know, if you think that there's no career opportunities for oil and gas professionals, that would be incorrect. And the reason is that renewables, as fast as they're growing, and we want them to grow faster, they will never be able to grow fast enough to replace all of the oil and gas that we're using now. So let's talk about liquid fuels. Liquid fuels power cars, trucks, and jets. Well, and ships. Now, ships might be able to be fitted with natural gas boilers. And cars over time might transition to EVs. But EVs today are less than 2%. And we've got hundreds of millions of cars just in the United States. So how long do you think it'll take for EVs to get to 50% or 80% of all the cars on the road? It's not going to happen in my lifetime. I don't think it'll happen in your lifetime either. Economists understand this, that kind of long-term development of the industries. It's not really discussed a lot in the media. There are places where you can read, for example, perhaps government agencies have done some work for planning purposes to figure out, well, how long will it take? Now, of course, if you have more EVs, the limiting factor there is cost. Availability of the materials to make the batteries. Now, you know, with everything that's happening around the world, we need to be able to make batteries here. But we don't make batteries here. So the components that go into making batteries, they're made in China. That's not sustainable. So it will take 10 or 20 years to develop the industry here in the United States, if we're really committed to doing it, to be able to crank out enough batteries to make our own batteries and to make our own EVs here in the United States. And then, by the way, that's going to stress the grid here, especially here in Texas. And our grid is at its limit right now. And we could build more renewables. We could build solar and we could build wind in West Texas and even offshore that they're talking about right now. However, the limiting factor there is there are not enough transmission lines to get the power from West Texas to Houston or Dallas, where it's consumed. And our government is not doing anything to help make that happen because our state leaders are not particularly interested in developing the renewable sector. It gets developed on its own through private investment, but only government can help create the right of ways to build transmission. So there's going to be a limiting factor. So there's a limit to how many EVs you could put on the road if you don't have enough electricity. Honestly, it's that simple. We're at our limit right now. Now, trucks run on diesel and there's no substitute right now. And it may take at least 20 years to develop a substitute. I can't even think of what that substitute would be. They've talked about fuel cells, or some company is making a battery powered truck and, you know, it has limited range. It's very heavy. There's going to be a lot of trial and error before we figure out how to eliminate the need for diesel. So you will always need petroleum for that. And it's even worse in the aviation industry. There is nothing that could possibly replace jet fuel. Now, jet fuel, you need oil. It's a product, is made in the refining of crude oil. You know, they make gasoline, they make diesel, they make jet fuel. And it's very cheap, but they need a lot of it. But it has a high energy content per volume. You know, a gallon of jet fuel, it's got a lot of heat content, right? So they can burn it and create massive thrust, put a jumbo jet into the air. But it is one of the passenger mile. They're consuming a ton of fuel, but there's no substitute for it. On the natural gas side, it's used in industry, but it's also used for power generation here in the United States and in Europe. And they make products out of it as well. They make fertilizer out of it. And if you don't have fertilizer, you don't have crops. There's no real way out of the dilemma, all of these dilemmas, in a 20-year time frame. So let's say you are fully committed as a government to increasing your amount of renewables as a percentage of your total energy consumption. And you will do everything you can to do that. What do you do in the meantime? Now, it turns out that historically, natural gas contracts, like to deliver LNG, historically, those have been 20-year contracts, but not because they thought they would need it for 20 years or more, which they knew that they did, but it would take that long to repay the debt to build the facility. So you need a contract that provides at least 20 years of guaranteed income to the exporting company so that they can go to the banks and borrow money to build the facility and then pay back the debt. It'll take 20 years. So from the 60s up until now, historically, LNG contracts have been done on a 20-year basis. The market is becoming more, they call it more liquid these days. So contracts don't have to be as long. There's more gas that is sold on a spot basis, meaning the price right now. And so the market is changing and it's becoming a more dynamic kind of market. But the reality is that Europe does not have gas resources. Asia does not have gas resources. So like we're talking China, Japan, and Korea, they don't have any gas. And all three of those countries have huge economies. They've been importing LNG since the 60s, and they will continue to need to import. They cannot build enough nuclear to satisfy all their electricity demand. They need gas for other purposes too. The need for LNG is not going away. We don't know what's going to happen in Europe over time, but at least for now, we know that Russia, it can no longer be considered a reliable supplier of gas. The decisions of where you're going to get your gas have a lot to do with the financing to build the facilities. So whatever you do, whatever you build, you need to pay back that debt. and it's going to take 20 years. So even if they don't do 20-year contracts, it'll still take 20 years to pay everything back anyway. Doesn't matter what the structure is. And what I'm talking about, when Germany is building two LNG receiving terminals, well, where's that money coming from? Some of it is coming from the government. Some of it is coming from banks. But we're talking billions of euro to do it in order to be able to receive LNG from the United States. And likewise, all of the LNG from the United States was already sold out before this crisis began. Like, there's a balance between the supply of LNG in the world and the demand of LNG in the world. And now all of a sudden, the demand of LNG in the world is much, much higher. So the supply has to catch up. And both sides, on both sides of the Atlantic, it requires billions of euros over there, billions of dollars over here. It'll take 3 years to build and 20 years to pay it back. Everything I'm talking about, they're trying to build as much renewable capacity as possible. They estimate that it will take, I believe our own government estimates that it'll take at least until 2050 for our economy to be running on half renewable, half everything else. How long would it take to get to 80% renewable? Well, they don't really know. You know, 30 years out, it's real hard to predict what's going to happen. 30 years from now, they might have an answer that is 20 years away. So I am telling you right now that our need for oil and gas is, let's say, a certainty 20 years out, and then may drop to, let's say, 80% certainty for the next 20 years after that. I have experience in the industry, but I am not on the management team of any major oil company. And the major oil companies are going to be investing in everything. They're going to invest in renewables. They're going to invest in oil and gas projects. And when I say invest, I'm talking billions of dollars that will be approved by their board. And they're doing it now, because if you don't invest, then 10 years down the road, there's a whole wedge of energy that's not going to be there. So you have to invest every year so that you have new supplies coming 10 years from now. So in other words, that is the best sign that tells you that oil and gas is not going away. There is talk also that in terms of career opportunities, that again, the reservoirs that are now depleted could become candidates for carbon sequestration. Well, who would know that? Well, you're going to need geologists and geophysicists on your team to do that. Instead of extracting oil and gas, now you know where the reservoir is. You'll be studying the rock properties and the seal properties to determine if that reservoir is a good candidate to inject carbon dioxide. How many of those jobs will there be? I predict there will be very few. I think there will be far more jobs for geologists and geophysicists to continue the exploration and extraction of oil and gas for at least the next 30 years. Just an economic fact. I think it's something that our government has been reckoning with just in the last few months. You know that just this week, the Senate passed the president's Inflation Reduction Act. All right. Well, but it's got like $370 billion for climate issues. And so that's tax incentives to build more renewables. But it also contains provisions to allow oil and gas leasing on federal lands for the next 10 years. In other words, there's something in it for everybody. Why did they do that? Well, they did that because a year or two ago, especially before COVID, they thought that this transition to renewables will happen sooner rather than later. But in the oil and gas industry said, no, that's not the reality. Please don't upset the apple cart here. That's not the reality. Well, 2 years later, here they're passing this bill, and they have realized that no matter how fast you build renewable capacity, you cannot stop exploring for oil and gas because we're going to need it for the next 20 or 30 years. There's a progressive wing that has argued for stopping oil and gas and just concentrating only on renewable. But I think that they've realized that you can't just stop oil and gas cold turkey. can't do it. You'll crush our economy. So I think there's got to be a transition that takes place over a pretty long period of time. And we're going to need young talent to come into the field in the next few years. And by the time guys that are your age, by the time you retire, maybe there will be 80% EVs on the road. Maybe. Honestly, I'm all for it. It could be the next car I buy. I might buy an EV. Okay. But I want to know that the state of Texas can deliver power before I do that. Right.
That was a pretty deep analysis of complicated problems. Do you have any final thoughts or comments to share, maybe about some advice for people that are interested in geophysics or geology to share before we end this podcast?
Oh, I don't know. Perhaps I've said too much already. I don't want to get anybody in trouble. But honestly, I've enjoyed every minute of my career, except those meetings that I told you about at the major oil company. It's been very rewarding. And I would say nobody has all the answers. We've talked about what the future could look like, but be prepared for a lot of twists and turns along the way. And I'd say you pick your major and get very good at your trade. And just like being a carpenter, you have your trade and you can work for anybody because you're really, really good at it, okay? But be very good at your trade, study hard. I still would advise going to work for a major. It's still the best training that you'll ever get, but it can be a lot of fun working in a smaller company once you have experience. But be adaptable, be willing to roll with the punches. I can't tell you, you know, where the career opportunities are going to be 20 years from now. I know we need oil and gas now. God knows we need it. And the Europeans, the whole world needs it. The free world needs it. And that's just not going to change. Gas is now a global market. And if we're exporting it, it means that we've got plenty here. So that means we need people to always be developing new fields because the old fields deplete. So just on and on and on and on. Somebody's got to be doing it for at least the next 20 years. You know, if you pick this as a major, you may decide, okay, I know my trade, I'm good at it, but I want to do something else in the industry. Well, once you have your trade, you can decide what you want to do. It's the same as going to medical school. Really good friend of mine in my class, Bob McDonald, he could have been one of the best doctors I ever met. But he got his MD, but he decided he didn't want to practice. He wanted to be a consultant and help companies navigate the complex health insurance industry. Well, the same can be true in an oil and gas profession. You might be a very good geophysicist, but you might decide that you may even want to start your own company, and you'll be dealing with landowners and drillers and engineers and accountants. And, you know, there's a lot to being a CEO of an oil and gas company. Geophysics is just a real small part of it. So once you get into the industry and you get exposed to all of the other disciplines that are required to produce energy, I think you'll find it's absolutely fascinating. And sky's the limit. And who knows what direction you're going to go.
Right. Thank you for taking time out of your day for this interview. I really, really appreciate it. And I learned a lot.
Well, I enjoyed it. Let me know if you have more questions down the road.
Thank you.
Thanks to everyone who's listening for choosing to spend your time with this podcast. I really appreciate it. Please be sure to check out pathfinder101.com for more information like this. Thank you, and have a great rest of your day.